Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today I have with me via Zoom from San Francisco, Manish Patel. Manish is the founder and managing partner of Nova Ventures, an early stage investment firm aimed at working with companies that endeavor to create new markets, change industries, and positively impact the world. He is a faculty member at Stanford University, where he teaches Introduction to Design Thinking. And with over a decade in venture capital, he focuses on investing in companies that seek to solve deep human needs through technology. Previously, Manish was a product leader at Google, working on key initiatives such as Google Ads, Maps, and TV, and laterally worked with Larry Page and ran OKRs, Google's famous objectives and key results management system. A graduate of Stanford with degrees in engineering and economics, he is also a fellow at the University of Toronto's Creative Destruction Lab, where he advises and mentors startups focused on developing products and services which leverage artificial intelligence and machine learning. In today's episode, we talk about the fact that people are people everywhere. You find rednecks even in Silicon Valley. We've got to stop equating wealth with brilliance. What does it mean to be a brown man in America? And how joining a nonprofit and then realizing he wasn't built for it led to his moving to Google just before their IPO. How Google went from the 50th search engine to number one. And when Churchill said, "We shape our buildings and therefore they shape us," he was talking about actual buildings. Today, those things are the products in our pockets. How building products that see the emotion behind the edge users is the way to go, and unlocking experience over efficiency in product design. How Manish became an accidental VC, and how he is rethinking the investment committee with kindness, truth, and hustle at its heart. And how the death of a VC firm is a good deal instead of a great deal. Manish's contrarian advice, it's okay to say I don't know. Let's get straight into it. This is Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it. Manish, it's great to have you here with me today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here. So excited to be on the pod.
Amazing. So look, just a quick question to kind of set the scene maybe. Can you tell me when you were born, where you were born, and where you are now?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely been a journey. You know, my family is from Indian by heritage, Uganda, East Africa, as Indians, particularly Gujaratis, were part of that diaspora.
Yeah.
Moved to the UK. I was born in the UK after Idi Amin came in the 70s. And so grew up the first part of my life in the UK, in the Midlands, in Derbyshire. And then after that, we kept moving west. My dad had a vision to like bring us to America, the land of opportunity, so to speak. And then we moved to the United States. I grew up a bunch of different places, from Ohio, North Carolina, a lot of my life in rural Kentucky of all places.
Amazing.
It's really in, Gujarati Patel form, living in motels and hotels, little roadside inns. And really, you know, I would say true entrepreneurship at its best. You know, there was no venture capital. It was like figuring out how to make these small businesses run and work. And then we moved around a lot through that journey in small little towns, eventually ended up in Virginia, and then was lucky enough to get a full scholarship to go to Stanford University, and that changed my life. My freshman year was right after the first dot-com bust, and my eyes were open to the power of technology and like what it meant to the world.
Mm. Amazing. Well, look, as we just heard, your family story clearly spans multiple countries and continents, from Uganda to the UK to the US, as you said. So how has that immigrant background shaped your worldview and influenced your career, both as an engineer working in product and ultimately as a venture capitalist? What lessons have you drawn from that journey, and how does that impact how you engage with founders today?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, at the human level, I would say people are people everywhere. And I think sometimes people forget that, you know, excuse me for saying so, but, you know, people would say in Kentucky, there are a lot of rednecks. There's a lot of rednecks in Silicon Valley. You know, there's a lot of brilliance in rural Kentucky and people that are just see the world in like a totally amazing way. In the same way, folks in Silicon Valley may say that, and they become founders of companies. So people are people. And I think sometimes, people, particularly in the world of venture capital tech, in today, get on their ivory tower, so to speak, right? Like they have a vision for the world, which is better for the world. And, we're going to save the world through technology or AI or what have you. And I think a little bit of humbleness is really good. And I think that's what I've learned, it's so important to come as a venture capitalist with a lot of humbleness and learning to really be a good listener and not just listen, but hear the entrepreneur. And I think that's something that I learned throughout my life journey because people are so different. Everyone's got amazing stories. And sometimes people are a product of their context, And I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley are fortunate to be here, There are many brilliant people in the world, but they got that lotto ticket. I'm one of the beneficiaries of the lotto ticket in life. And, you got exposed to technology and engineering and the right things, the right time, the right network of people. And that allows you to go create, And one thing I love is when I meet entrepreneurs and people that really understand the responsibility they have. If you're so fortunate that get one of these lotto tickets in life, do something worthwhile. I really do think if there was more of that sort of honoring of that, there'd be just like much better companies built in the world. And I think sometimes what you see in venture capital today and these hype cycles, et cetera, I think some of that would go away because people would go back to basics, go back to sort of, I'm going to build a product. It's going to be of value. It's not about growth hacking and this and that. It's about really doing something useful to someone. And that's what gets me excited. That has really informed me in my travels in venture, having done it now 14 years, what I get excited about when I invest.
There's a couple of points there that I think I'd love to pick up on, right? So one, exactly as you say, the opportunity to build really meaningful stuff is very much there. And we're seeing it more coming out of, traditionally what would have been considered developing economies. So if I look at Africa, some of the technology that's built out there is super interesting and is solving problems that are not problems that we necessarily in the West would consider or need to solve, right? But those stories are just as important as, so solving logistics in East Africa is just as important in East Africa as it is, solving how do you land a rocket on a, in a pair of chopsticks, right? As we're seeing in the US at the moment. So I think that's super interesting. I think the second part of that is I was watching this Twitter conversation recently. And it was a founder of, one of the neobanks here in the UK was saying, how do we build that entrepreneurial spirit? And I have a lot of opinions on that here in the UK. I think we have a real class structural problem, which impacts, I think a lot of people don't feel like they can follow that sort of a dream. Like the American dream is a very obvious and famous kind of example of that. Whereas in the UK, I think people feel bound by their class heritage or by the heritage or their upbringing or their circumstances or their relationships. And we have a fairly negative kind of not work, and negative is maybe strong, but we have a fairly sanguine view towards entrepreneurship, right? We tend to worship old money, but be slightly snide and sneery of new money. And actually, the bit that came up was one of the respondents said, "Well, we've got this new government in, and they're about to raise capital gains tax to like, 35, 36, whatever percent, whatever it might be." And of course, that hasn't been announced yet. And the response, which was actually really was very thoughtful in itself, because this founder who had come from the UK, gone to the US. And is now, I think, working with Wycom, if I'm not mistaken. But he just turned around and said, "Well, San Francisco has had 38% capital gains tax for a decade. Doesn't seem to have stopped them, right?" So, what is that? What would you put that down to? Is it just because that's become the flywheel effect of having so many success stories there, or is it something else? What's a magic sauce from your perspective?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a few thing and few things, and I do think it's generational. I think even in the U.S., right? I think starting a company in New York City or in the East Coast is very different culturally than starting a company in Silicon Valley. Here, if you go to a cocktail party and you say, "Hey, I started three companies, they all failed, but I gave it a go, I gave it a shot," you get a lot of social credibility, right? And there's a celebration of that, right? If you say, "Well, I'm an executive at a Fortune 500 company, you're not the most interesting guy at the party, you know? But if you go to other places, you are, right? And I think that's where I think it's really about this drive to reshape the world through a product lens, importantly. And I can talk more about that. And I think that really started back in the day with Hewlett and Packard, you know? Like that company really made Silicon Valley. It was started during the Great Depression of all times, right? Not a great time to be starting a company. And so the fact that like that then has started sort of the model of the like two guys in a garage building something tech oriented that can like shape the world. I think that story, because it was successful, got a lot of people excited. And I think you know, well, there's always wealth and old pockets of money. I think that people are like, oh, I can do that too. People that, you know, maybe came from nothing can kind of jump up the social ladder, do something great. And I do think it also is something where it happens within a small lifetime. You know, it's not sort of over a period of 50 years or 100 years because your great grandfather was part of the Crusades or something and like, you know, stole land from somebody and that's how you accumulated wealth. I think the thing that's really funny right now, culturally, that's happening is not the innovation economy and the people that want to start companies, but the narrative that's out there. And you know, I teach at Stanford and I talk to young kids all the time. There's this equating wealth with brilliance, which I think is totally false. You know, like just because somebody's a rich person does not mean they're a smart person, you know? And, you know, I think that's the thing that, you know, when you think about even the recent Nobel Prize winners, right? Brilliance. The kind of celebration that should be getting relative to like somebody's IPO or some guy that's a billionaire doing, you know, whatever crazy billionaire stuff is relatively muted, you know? The conversation should be about, oh my gosh, this is fundamental research that's going to change humanity, right? Not like, oh, this guy's worth billions of dollars and doing some crazy billionaire stuff. And I think we really need to work on changing that narrative.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, obviously I mean, we can't talk about it on the podcast because your ex-employer actually gets very upset with us when we do. But obviously, you know, we're recording this in October 2024. There's stuff happening in the US, as most people would appreciate. But I do find, I mean, but it's not just, you know, this time around. There has been this constant kind of fiddling at the edges that suggests that because you've been a venture capitalist and invested in some stuff that then was successful, or even have built something that was successful, that gives you domain expertise across everything else, which is just not the case, right? You can be very smart and very thoughtful, but to then sort of assume that you are, you know, that you are able to, you know, get into the weeds around policy decisions and how do you know, how do you run an educational system across the UK? And I look, I'm guilty of doing it, of course, right? Like everyone is, we all have opinions. But I think the difference is when those opinions start being taken as fact by people just on the basis that, well, okay, this person was successful, therefore they must know what they're talking about. And clearly that, you know, that can be proven to be untrue in many, many circumstances.
Absolutely. And I think what's happened in Silicon Valley, which has kind of amplified that, is the myth of Steve Jobs, you know, where brilliant human being, you know, obviously he had some issues as well, but created amazing products and companies, right? And I think a lot of founders kind of say, well, I'm going to channel Steve Jobs, right? I am that. And I often say that's crazy. There was one Steve Jobs in history, right? You cannot just copy that and do what he did. Also, the context in which he existed, what was happening in the early 80s that allowed him to do what he needed to do and formed him, right? And I think a lot of people pattern match the wrong things. Instead of creating their own narrative and really figuring out and being self-reflective, who am I right now as an entrepreneur, as a founder? What's happening within my market context? And how does that inform my direction? And you know, while I love how thick the ecosystem has become with advisors and blogs and all kinds of information, the challenge with that is like people don't spend enough time actually soul searching and thinking about, you know, what do I want to do? And I meet a lot of founders that are entrepreneurial, but not entrepreneurs, right? They want to be part of the journey, but really being a founder is so incredibly difficult. You know, and I don't think you can templatize it. I don't think you can kind of read a book and be like, okay, I you know, I took the course on founding, so now I'm going to be a founder. You know, there's a big difference between going through the motions and actually doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I worked with a founder once that said to me, and it was a business that should never would never raise venture, and I knew it wouldn't. Yeah. And I told them that at the time, and they were like, but I've done everything it said on, in the lean startup. And I'm like, okay, great. Yeah. But that doesn't mean you can raise venture. And I think to your point, yes, there is a lot of information out there. We talked about some of this earlier. And I'm fairly guilty of putting a fair amount of information out there as well. But part of the information I say is whatever I've written, whatever I say, you can't take as golden. Whatever is context for you is context for you. This worked here, this worked in this instance, and it worked, you know, and may have worked more than once based on my experience. But that doesn't mean it will work for you, and you've got to figure out what does. I want to shift gears slightly. You talked about the two, you know, the two founders in a garage, and you know, your previous employers are famous for having gone through that journey. In fact, we've had one of the partners from Wilson Sonsini on the podcast before, who took that particular founding team right from incorporation right through to the IPO as legal counsel. But you previously worked in a nonprofit working with disadvantaged immigrant populations, which must have been incredibly rewarding whilst incredibly difficult work. But you then joined Google, right? The famous two guys in the garage just before IPO and having said no five times already. So working on product across a number of divisions, and towards the end of your time there, you're working with Larry Page running the OKRs, which were, you know, Google's famous objectives and key results sort of monitoring system. So can you walk me through the journey here? Because these are two very, very different paths, right? So on the one hand, the nonprofit, and then on the other hand, and, you know, a behemoth about to IPO. So what were the learnings that came out of that whole period of your life?
Yeah, you know, at the time it was random, but then upon reflection, kind of thinking about who I was and figuring out what I was, it was about how do you make impact? How do you make a dent in the universe, right? And so I had moved to the nonprofit world because as somebody, as a brown man in America, often people have assumptions about who you are and where you've came from, right? Whether it's like your parents are doctors or you're a doctor or whatever, just because of the way you look, or an engineer. And there's a lot of people that aren't, right? And I went to work for this nonprofit, which was specifically working on it with Asian immigrants that had real problems where, you know, you're in a terrible marriage, and if you get divorced, you get deported back to India or Vietnam or what have you. I mean, these are real problems. And it was amazing work. And as you said, incredibly difficult, but probably the most important work I've ever done, you know, really deeply impacting someone's life. And I realized I wasn't built for that, right? Like the emotion, the strength it takes, it's really hard every day to kind of go in. And, you know, and what I realized, well, where's my mind naturally going? I had studied engineering at Stanford. I love technology, and I was kind of, you know, it's kind of the question of, you know, when after 5 o'clock, what are you doing? Well, I'm reading about products. I'm trying to build products in my spare time, right? It's like obsessive about products and building. And so I was like, okay, this is interesting. Like, let me like honor that part of who I am. I love software, always tinkering. And, you know, I was not bright enough to say yes to Google the first time I got an offer, to your point. Some of my friends had gone there. A lot of folks had Stanford, obviously, had great connectivity to Google. And they're like, Manish, you don't understand how special this company is. It's not just a search company. Google was the 50th search engine, right? And I was like, hey, it's great. But I didn't see that it was going to be a $1 trillion company when I was 21. You know, I was like, okay, it's cool, whatever. And there's Yahoo and other stuff. They're like, no, this is a very special culture, a really special place. You just have to spend time out here and really understand it. And I thought, well, let me go back to California. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time on the East Coast. I said, let me go back to California. Maybe I'll start a company. Maybe I'll learn a little bit from this other startup and I'll be off to the races, you know. Well, I was at Google, and the book of life, better be lucky than good. I joined a little bit before the IPO. It changed my life. I spent most of my 20s there, was fortunate to be learning from just some incredible people as they became these incredible people, right? Whether it's Larry Page or Susan Wojcicki, who recently passed away, or just all these amazing leaders and being able to get exposed to them. And I think the thing that got me so excited, and because of who I am, I love products. And there's this thing, you know, in honor of Winston Churchill, let's say, since you're across the pond, you know, he has this great quote, which I appreciate. You know, we shape our buildings and therefore they shape us, right? Architecture shapes us, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was as he was redesigning the House of Commons or what have you. And I think, you know, what are the buildings of today? I think they're products, right? I think about my iPhone. I think about my laptop, whatever. the millions of man hours and engineering that goes into building that thing, it's like the cathedrals of 100 years ago, right? Or the temples, what have you, the pyramids. That is like the new architecture of today. And that is what I love. You know, like while I'm interested in politics and social issues and all these things, I'm not a politician. I'm pretty bad at politics, actually. But what got me excited was I can design something. Maybe how I hold this phone, maybe how I have this interaction on the web puts me in a different mood, right? Because it makes me feel a little bit better, whatever it is. Changes how I see the world a little bit. And I can talk more about that with building Google Maps. And how does that then impact the rest of my day, right? And so that was the thing that got me excited in this idea of like impact, right? So going from nonprofit to Google is a random journey.
Just to interject for a second, I interviewed a friend of mine who worked with Microsoft a while, you know, a while ago, and she was at a female leaders forum. And I think the speaker like pulled out their phone from the bag, and they said, you know, if there had been a woman on that product team, the phone wouldn't have been black, right? And because it's black, it gets lost in your handbag. And you know, to your point, how we think about building products is so influenced by our own experiences, our own personalities, our own genders, our own, you know, backgrounds, all of those sort of things, which is why often, and we'll talk about product a little bit later as well, it's why often really great, you can have really great ideas that serve a market, but the product can actually just really kill it off, right? Like just make it fail.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the best products really, actually, maybe 2 points there. One, I think when you're building products, I really don't like the narrative of build something for yourself because I think it's hard to see yourself. I think it's really, I teach this at Stanford, really spend time looking at the extreme users, those people on the fringes, right? Really try to see who they are, take out your biases in that, you know? And I think the best products are actually ones that people see the needs of other people and these deep human needs, you know, not just like, oh, it's hard to do something, but they're the emotion behind it. And I think that's really exciting when you start to build products. And I think great product people are doing that all the time. You know, it's not just in a technology context. They're thinking about a spoon, a chair, how does it sit in my hand? You know, why is something a certain way? One of the things I think about now in Silicon Valley as people build products is there's been this move to faster is better, right? Why is that? And I think, you know, Google suffered from this. You know, Google won, I think, in part because the interface was so lightweight, and people at that time, 20 years ago, there was so much garbage on the homepages of Yahoo and others. It took a long time to load, very slow. Google was fairly sparse, went really fast, right? That learning got translated now. Efficiency is the key to best products, right? I think that's totally wrong. And I think about an example would be like, you know, if I'm flying to London from San Francisco, people are like, oh, you just want to get there as fast as possible. I'm like, but do I? Instead of just flying in like, you know, a business class and being there or economy, whatever, like, what if it was a spa, right? What if my vacation or my business trip started instead of a 10-hour journey? What if it was like a nice 15-hour, luxurious, like amazingly refreshing journey
But
on
an
that flight?
experience as opposed to just getting from A to B.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's where my hope is. With a lot of the new kind of AI tooling and things that are happening, it's gonna unlock new creativity because, you know, we've been in a world where speed was king or queen and allowed people to do things. But my hope is that that becomes less interesting because everything will happen fast. So better products will now be pushed to do things that are like different around experiences and deeper experiences.
And I think we went through a little bit of that, right? When there was the spate of funding, I guess, you know, in the 2018 to 22 kind of period, everything was about experiential products, and but maybe experiential from a luxury standpoint rather than from a usability standpoint, right? And you know, we kind of flip back and forth. So, you know, some people want to have the you know, the phones that have zero you know, zero visual, zero color, etc. So very sparse kind of real estate on the phone screen, no distractions. And then of course you have on the other side, you have those that want, you know, everything. So to your point, it's about figuring out where you sit within those edge cases, like what is the product who is it serving ultimately, and why are they using it, and what are you going to do with that? I don't think it's solvable across everyone, right? Because your idea of a good experience is that. My wife's idea of a good experience on a plane is not to be on the plane, right? So that's a very different, if you then gave her an additional 3 hours beforehand where she's got to think about getting on the plane, she may not love it. But the point is, I definitely agree that if you sacrifice everything for efficiency, you lose some of the magic that you could bring into the product, which would actually make users truly love it. And we always talk about, 1,000 true fans, right? Like, you really do want those people that absolutely love and adore what it is that you're building. So let's move on, because, as you mentioned, you teach an intro to design thinking course at Stanford. So from your perspective, what is it that makes an outstanding product? You talked about experience just now. And what do you see founders getting wrong most often when they're thinking about building, certainly in today's environment?
Yeah, I mean, the framework I use, which is what I teach at Stanford, of like, what makes a great product? I think they're at the intersection of three things. If you imagine sort of a Venn diagram, I think it's at the intersection of technology, business, and human needs. So those three things. And technology is really a measure of the feasibility of something, right? So if I were to build a rocket ship, right? Mm. Does the technology even exist to build that, right? Or do I have to invent the new technology? Do I have to invent rocket fuel? Do I have to invent aerodynamics, right? How much of it is research and how much of it is there? How much is actually engineering, right? So the feasibility is really important. The next piece is the viability of something. And this is the business model, right? If it costs, and this is maybe relevant in the world of AI, $100 billion to just see if something works, how viable is that as a business, right? It's like, well, I hope that business then creates trillions of dollars of change in the world. But if you're, if it's $100 billion just to test out the idea, is it viable, right? And I think that's a good question to always be asking for business, right? So that viability piece. And the last piece is the desirability. And I think this is the piece often that people don't think a lot about, is like, do people really want to use it in terms of what are the deep latent human needs? And I think that a lot of people build products and they give to somebody and like, oh, here's the metric, here it is, great, I got some clicks. The test that I always love to do is say, if I gave you something for a week and I took it away, would you care?
Yeah.
Right? Is it become part of your daily life? Is it really become a habit? And I think today for most people, whether it's in your corporate life, business life, or home life, there's so many demands on our time. Does this really take a little bit of that time? Is it something where I'm going to extract that time and build? And I think the myth I think a lot of founders have is like, a great product is all you need, right? It's not the better mousetrap. You also have to think about the market itself. And this goes to that product piece. If you're a young company, you're not the Googles of the world, but you're young, you're relatively resource constrained, you're time constrained. You're really, trying to do something great with not a lot. I think the thing that I think is so important is the best products at the early stage actually are working on A+ problems and A+ markets. And it could be like a B+ C product. It could be very rough around the edges, but that human need, that pain point is so great. Even if something's a little broken, I want to use it, right? And I think that then buys you the time to go and build the better product over the coming years. I think it's really hard to do that out of the box.
I think that's super interesting. The reason I say that as well is like, living in the world I do, which is obviously, CFO and CFO sort of function within startups, I see a lot of people trying to build CFO tech at the moment, and I don't think any of it works. They're all beautiful, right? Like, they're really geeky, interesting technical problems that they've solved, but they in no way, shape, or form, for the most part, grab me and say, wow, like, this is something that I'm like, if I don't use this product daily in my job, like, right, I can't do my job, right? And this is the problem. Now, there are some at the transactional layer, but actually what's interesting, and I think this is the same for a lot of products, is because of the way you think about technology as abstracting, where you average out, right? So you're basically trying to reach as many people as possible rather than as few people as possible. And that's the whole problem with scale. you actually end up not serving the true users. And it's what you said earlier, you've got to find those edge cases where people are passionately, you know, desperate for the solution. And it actually, you know, if I'm building a spreadsheet and a formula breaks, that's existential for me. Like, I'm pulling my hair out, right? If a product does not do something that really solves that for me, you know, that really makes me feel like, well, that is a problem I'm never going to see again, and oh my god, you know, this just saves me all the time, money, and I love looking at it, then it's just not a product that I'm really going to bother. And equally, if I have to spend a huge amount of time learning how to use it, to your point, we live in an attention deficit economy, right? If you are going to have to spend days or hours trying to figure out how to use something, you've essentially failed from the start, right? Because that users are not happy to have to necessarily go through that whole process.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting, you think about the CFO point. You see a lot of these AI tools trying to automate away a CFO.
Yeah.
I think about it.
I try to build one.
So, yeah. Oh, there you go. Okay. So my lens, we have an amazing CFO in our firm, right? And like, you know, maybe some AI could try to automate him. But for me, as an owner of my firm, the risk there is huge. It's binary risk, right? Like, I don't care about like saving 30% more dollars. If I get my books wrong, that's, my firm goes out of business, right? If you have the wrong kind of reporting, that's like a catastrophic fail case, right? So maybe there's things around bookkeeping that can be automated, but I still want hey, is there a human being validating this, right? Because the risk is so high. Maybe the AI is so good that risk gets moved away. But like, I definitely wouldn't want to be the early adopter that's like, well, I, you know, I'm willing to take on that binary risk because I saved 20%, you know, in terms of my yearly spend on financials.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, this is a whole separate topic and debate. I mean, I absolutely agree with everything you just said there, because I think the difference is, and this is where technology is. So technology as an enabler is great. I don't think it's ever a replacer. And part of the reason, especially in sort of, you know, at least at right now, to your point, things may change in 3, 5, 10 years or even earlier, who knows. But the reason that lawyers exist or CFOs exist, it's not because they are following a set of rules, or not always following a set of rules. A lot of it comes back to judgment and experience and gut, right? Like, there are things that I can tell you if that balance sheet looks wrong. Yeah. I can't tell you why I've intrinsically figured that out, but I can, because I've seen a lot of bad balance sheets in my life. I mean, look, I think that whole question around product is so important, because the other thing that's happening at the moment is, now with some of this generative AI, people are able to build websites and products at the snap of a finger. Now the question is, are they building meaningful, and does the AI actually understand what good product looks like, to your point, right? Or does it spit out something that can do the job that you've asked it to do, but actually with none of the nuance or none of the value that a really truly kind of artisanally built product would give you?
I mean, what I think is, over time, it may start to understand these things, but that's going to be a, you know, 50-year journey. I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 years, right? I think what will happen in the next 10 years with AI is that it will enable a new ability for people to be creative and empowered. Just like, you know, in my view, as an old guy in the 90s, you know, in the web, the information superhighway, as it was called back then, and how it empowered so many people to get connected and do so many amazing things, which would have been possible before, right? And I love that. And I think, you know, business models got disrupted and evolved from the newspaper industry and otherwise, right?
Yeah, the obvious one, blogs to journalism, and the defragmentation of all of the kind of newspaper and media industry, yeah.
All of it. And it happened so quickly, right? And I think this is going to happen even faster. The thing that I think is really interesting that often gets left out of the discussion is that the people that lived through that disruption are still alive today, right? And some of these people have built big companies, right? So they know the power of disruption. Many of the leaders of companies that were there in the 90s, you know, they didn't understand the true power of technology. So they had not seen it. Right. And now the world, I think, has seen technology as the great driver in information technology and the way we're talking about Silicon Valley technology. So I'm actually very interested to see where, if you're Salesforce, take an example, right? There's gonna people like, oh, some AI system's gonna disrupt Salesforce and they're an old school CRM and whatever and whatever. I'm like, well, Mark Benioff is a pretty smart guy. Salesforce is a juggernaut. They know the power of AI because they're building this stuff. They understand where they sit in the ecosystem, So I don't think this idea of the innovator's dilemma, excuse me, is as valid today with the
Because
type of
everyone has
companies.
access, right? Whereas, so unless there is a huge paradigm shift, and AI is a pretty big one, right? But it's one that can be adopted. But if there is just a completely transformational technology, I mean, so the obvious one is when the iPhone came out. The reality was smartphones already existed. I remember having a Windows smartphone back in the day, right? But it never, the adoption was never there. But essentially, iPhone killed off Nokia, right? Because it did, right? That was the disruptive force. But the reality is that with AI, everyone has access, everyone knows what they're doing. And these were companies that, as you said, had already disrupted other industries in the past. And therefore, they are looking out for what is going to disrupt them. And I think that is the big change from, because things have moved so quickly. I don't think, that pace of change wasn't there 30, 40 years ago. That pace of change has very clearly been there for the last, two, 3 decades, right? I want to move on a little bit. You describe yourself as an accidental VC. So what do you mean by that? And what would you consider to be VC 101 for those that are kind of curious? And what is it that has influenced you the most as you set out to build Nava Ventures, which I must say is Sanskrit for new? And what have you done differently from your perspective?
I mean, accidental venture capitalist. I mean, I think for me, if you ask the young Manish, the 22-year-old Manish, would you want to be a venture capitalist? I would have said absolutely not. I have zero interest in finance. I'm much more. I want to be in the ring, not on the sidelines. I want to be the guy building the products. I want to be kind of in the weeds, right? And that's where my natural inclinations were. That's how I grew up, right? The 0 to 20 version of me was all about building products and tinkering. And, it wasn't about reading the Wall Street Journal or thinking about, equity and stock and structuring companies, what have you. That was definitely not just being discussed around my dinner table when I was growing up. And frankly, when I, even today as a venture capitalist, I don't admire the people that you would say are the best in the world venture capitalists. They're wonderful, they're smart and great, and I've been fortunate to spend time with folks like the John Doors of the world, et cetera. But it's not like, wow, I will live the good life if I'm that,
Yeah,
right?
you're not
I
trying to emulate what they've done.
No, absolutely not. And I think from a business lens, the people I do admire are people like the Steve Jobs of the world, Larry Pages of the world, that really have sh created things that have shaped the world that will live on well beyond them. And I think that's really exciting. And so how I stumbled into venture capital was, in my late 20s, so early in my career, Google had gotten very big. I was thinking about, well, what do I want to do next? Google, and I think of this as physics of big companies. It's just became more about people establishing structure and fiefdoms and things to operate better. And I kind of saw that movie happening, and it wasn't something that I was excited to be a part of. I love building my projects and kind of the people I knew. And I was like, well, what do I want to do? Maybe I'll go start a company. I feel like that's where my heart is. That's what I love, right? And I thought about starting something within Google. My last project there was actually I built an Air Force as part of a team to map the world, which was a lot of fun. So a big heavyweight infrastructure project, right? It wasn't like I'm gonna build a photo sharing app, right? So I was trying to think through like infrastructure scale projects to work on at Google, because actually I think that's what Google should do. Google should not be building social apps like share photos, right? That does not merit the responsibility of what the company should do. They should go map the world. That seems like a worthwhile project, one of the most powerful companies in the world. I couldn't really figure out what I wanted to do at Google. So then I was like, let me go start a company. And then through that, I was like, well, how do people start companies? And I kind of, fell into the myth of, well, you start a company because you go to raise venture capital. That's how you do it, right, in Silicon Valley, right? A great myth that many people, Don Valentine, all these amazing people created. And so I was like, well, let me go learn about that. Let me go and learn the dark arts of venture, right? So I started talking to a few venture capital firms. One firm was kind enough to give me an incredible offer. They were like, hey, why don't you come here for like a year? We'll teach you about venture, the business of venture. If you want to go raise a seed fund, if you want to be an entrepreneur, let's just see how it goes. And I was like, oh, this is great. I'm gonna kind of see the other side of the table, see all the secrets. I'm gonna be better for it. I'm gonna go then start my own company. What happened in that journey was I fell in love with working with the entrepreneur. It was just such a job of privilege, so humbling every day. You meet five or six people that tell you a secret about how they're gonna change the world, right? They spent thousands of hours thinking about something, and you're like, oh, tell me more. And I get to watch this great documentary a few times a day. And like, if I'm excited, not only do I get to invest in them from a capital perspective and help them build that company, but from a reputation and network, et cetera. And I was able to take all those learnings from Google during that hyper growth period and start to give those out to companies I was working with. And so that's what made me fell in love with venture capital. I think there's a lot of problems with the industry. I think it's broken in some ways. I think it's beautiful in others. But that's how I ended up as this kind of accidental venture capitalist. And now it's been 14 years, and I love so much about what I do every day.
And so how, I mean, I think that's the best way to get into venture, if I'm honest, right? Discovering it as a passion whilst doing it, as opposed to having sort of made a calculated attempt to get into the industry. And you see a lot of that, especially the young people. They want to be VCs because they maybe listen to podcasts like this, see people that they respect and admire, and like, I want to be like him. To your earlier point, right? There can only be one Steve Jobs. There can only be one Manish Patel. There can, there can only be one John Doerr, et cetera. Actually, you've got to find your own path. And sometimes the best way of doing that is by doing things unintentionally. I talk a lot about serendipity, right? Like, so just going out, doing stuff, meeting people, having conversations and seeing what arises, because you really don't know what is going to arise. And the minute you start, in fact, the worst decisions I've made in my life have been ones that have been down a concrete plan. The best decisions have been as a result of just seeing what happens. Like, obviously there's some form of a plan, but the plan is incredibly flexible, right? And so, what then did you learn? You talked about some parts are broken, some parts are beautiful. So when you set up Nava, how did you try and address those parts that you feel are broken? Like how do you think about that?
Absolutely. And I think maybe one concrete example here is investment committee. So I think of it as it's the most expensive meeting of the week for my firm, because everybody's in the room together. We're not meeting anybody else. We're just looking at each other, right? And so we're burning capital, and we're like trying to make important decisions. Like, do we go forward with the company, or do we not go forward with the company, right? Highly emotional, some data, some, spiritual at some level, just figuring out, I don't know, oh God, help me out here. So, and I think about our investment committee and what we've done differently at Nava and compared to a lot of people in Silicon Valley. And the theory of the investment committee is supposed to be this like beautiful discussion that's very messy about here's what I love, here's what I don't love about a deal. And you have these sort of people intellectualizing, bringing in their industry experience, et cetera, and hopefully coming to a good answer, right? The reality is, if you talk to a lot of people, maybe after a beer or two, that are general partners in Silicon Valley at big firms, right? If you ask them, and many of my friends, like, what's the most painful part of your week? They'll be like Sunday night before their Monday morning
Preparing for the
investment.
IC, yeah.
And because what happens at that investment committee meeting is that you end up selling your deal, right? You can't really show weakness. You can't really say, well, here's the 10 things I like, here's the three things I don't. I'm not sure about it, but I think there's something special here, right? Because then you'll get ripped apart by the partners. Be like, how? But the reality is, particularly for early stage companies, there is no A pluses all the way down,
There's
right?
always
You're not.
risk, right? Like there's always potential for failure.
Totally. And I think you end up having this kind of group think, or you have this kind of discussion where like the senior partner says something and 80% of what everybody else says is what the senior partner says, right? It's like this kind of clever business school conversation versus a real conversation. And what I love about what we've tried to do here at Nava, and I hope we can really hold on to it with our culture, we're a team of seven growing to eight, nine now, is having those really honest conversations where I love it, where like the youngest analyst on our team is 23. When she disagrees with me in front of my entire partnership, right? She's like, you're seeing it totally wrong. You're saying it's blue. I think it's totally red. And this is why. And really having that discourse, because you can still do a deal, but let's have like honest eyes on it, right? Really understanding the risks that you're taking, because that'll make for better investment and that'll make for better decision making. And my hope is that within our investment committee, that we have better decision making, which will hopefully lead to better deals, performance, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something I think that is critical to how a venture firm operates.
But I mean, which is incredible, and I completely get it, right? Like, I mean, we talk about this as CFOs in the rooms with founders all the time. Like, our job is not to tell you what you think the numbers are. Our job is to tell you what the numbers are and what the implications of those numbers may be and what decision paths there may be. And there is never one decision path, right? There are six or three or 10 or whatever, but that, you know, we don't live in a world of binary. We live in a world of multiple options. But I guess the question then for you is, how do you build that culture, right? Because you know, clearly it, for a 23-year-old analyst to be able to stand up to the managing partner and say, well, I think you're wrong. Like, they need to have the trust that they're not going to get kicked out the door if they say that, right? So how do you encourage or build that culture? Because I would see that, I mean, you know, businesses, and I think most people, we're still stuck in this paradigm of seniority, and which is why we have, you know, structures of CEOs and vice presidents and, you know, then juniors and managers or whatever, right? Like that hierarchy exists, and most organizations that have tried flat organization structures don't seem to work, you know, particularly well, or they have other challenges for sure, right? But so how do you encourage that transparency and openness without, you know, whilst making it safe for that person, you know, to not be in fear of their job, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it starts with culture, right? And I think we keep it simple. Three core values drive us, right? Kindness, truth, hustle. Kindness is kind of a funny one in venture capital. You don't hear that often. And I think it's important. I think it's important because from a culture of kindness, you can become your best self. You can become a manager of risk. You can learn, you can fail a little bit and pick yourself up. So you have these very rigid structures where people are afraid to talk. You won't get people understanding what risk is, right? They just become sycophants. They just become yes men, right? And I think from that culture of kindness internally, we really try to tell people, like, we want you to take risk, right? It's okay to make mistakes. In fact, if you don't make a mistake, you're probably not doing the job right. You know, like, we obviously, we want to avoid catastrophic fail cases. That's kind of our job. But you want to have the ability to learn and grow, because that will speed up the learning loops, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about learning loops with our CEOs, with us ourselves internally. You want that to happen as fast as possible. And the second value we have is truth. And that, in my mind, is like truth seeking. Not to get too academic, but that kind of idea of Marcus Aurelius, like, what is the fundamental nature of something, right? What is the nature of this thing? You know, I think what's happened today in venture is, like, there are a million blogs that are people that are investment banking analysts or pseudo banking analysts that have all these metrics, and they're trying to, like, boil it down to a science of, like, this is your KPIs, therefore you get this multiple, this and that. And I think that's totally wrong. I think there's one lens, but it's not the lens.
I was just going to say, yeah, that whole piece around data-driven venture, I go very hot and cold. Like, I think there is a, I think there, because you get trapped in, you know, you get trapped in this loop of, you know, you have bias towards the companies. So it's essentially, you're looking at everything through lens, through the success stories, right? So that leaves out the reality of venture, which is it's the edge cases that are often the most impressive, right? So if you build your portfolio based on a data-driven approach, you may have good returns on average for the most part, but you probably miss out on those extraordinary returns which come from the human element of there's something there, right? Like, I spoke to the founder and there's just something there. Like, I get it. Like, there's a product. Yeah, the product, to your earlier point, maybe is messy around the edges, but there is something there, right? Now, data may not take you to that decision, right? Like, and I'm not saying that you should therefore avoid data in any decision making. Obviously, data is a good thing, but you have to leave room for those conversations and for that. And it goes back to what we're saying about why you want your CFO in the room, not AI, to take over, because it's that intuition, it's that experience, it's that gut that also, you know, informs how you move forward with this sort of stuff. It's one of these things which I'm starting to see come up a lot more. There's lots of people talking about building data-driven investment processes, and I'm just not sure. I think is I think, where I land.
Oh, I agree with that. And I think if you do that, I think it's a lens, but not the lens, to your point, right? You need data, right? But if your only lens is data, as you look at this, I think you end up with, I love this quote from Robert Smith. He's the founder of Vista Equity, which is, you know, an amazing private equity firm. He's like, you know, all software kind of tastes like chicken, right? And it's like, yeah, if you're doing all vertical SaaS stuff, it's all kind of the same. And you can look at most of it through kind of a purely quant lens, and you probably get to about the same answer. And you're not going to get 1,000x return on that, but you can probably get a good return on that, right? Mm. And my business of early stage venture, I'm in the game of like 1,000x return, right? If you can build a Google, a Facebook, you know, the companies that really do reshape the world, that's what I'm hoping to do. And so, you know, when I look at my fund performance, actually I tell my team this a lot. The death of our firm is the good deal versus the great deal. The good deal is where somebody checks all the boxes. You know, they went to Stanford, Harvard Business School. Yeah. They worked at Google. They like worked at McKinsey, etc. Oh, they're working in a market that's growing, you know, like great. But like, what's the controversy? What's their quirky point of view? What's the weird thing that they're going to do and see that no one else can see? And so, and that's how you get to the great deal. It should be a little bit weird, right? It should be something that doesn't check every single box, you know? I always tell my team also, you know, founders need to tell us a secret. Yeah. Tell us the unknown unknown, right? Tell us that weird perspective on the world. And I think that's really important in the early stage. And you can't quite boil that down to like a spreadsheet or a memo. You know, there's something about the feel of it that makes it different as a company.
Yeah, no, I love that view. And I would definitely prescribe to that. I got one final question, which actually, given everything we've just talked about, may end up with an odd answer. But what is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction on from any area of life, whether it's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is a hill that you would die on defending?
Hmm. You know, I would say be vulnerable. And it's okay to say, I don't know. I think we're in a world where everybody is an expert and everybody assumes the experts have all the answers. And, you know, if you can't, in the soundbite world, if you don't have an answer in 30 seconds, people think, well, you don't know what you're talking about. And I think I would love it if more people said, I don't know. And, you know, but what I do know is I'll work a problem really hard with you and we will get to an answer together, mm-hmm. collaborating, mm-hmm. right? And I think there needs to be more room for that. I think a lot of venture capitalists always think they have to have the right answer. I love telling my portfolio companies, I don't know, you know, but what I do know is these three things and you know those three things. So like, what's the work, the problem? Mm-hmm. I hate this thing that's happened where everybody gives these rule of thumbs advice, you know? It's like, well, I read that TechCrunch blog post too, you know? That was some clever one-liner, but that's not really truth, you know? Every company is different. Every company needs to really understand the context in which you're working. And so say, I don't know, you know, I've seen this in the past and this could be here, but let's think about your specific situation. And I think that's a pretty contrarian thing to actually do in a board meeting or with an entrepreneur to be like, I don't know. Mm. And I would love it if more people started doing that, because I think I'd get to a lot more truth and get us out of these kind of hype cycle, Twitter storms, whatever, where people kind of pontificate and it's like, well, that sounds nice, but in reality, how would I do that, you know, in my company, you know?
I mean, I'm laughing because obviously this has brought us full circle to like the start of our conversation before we started recording. But equally, I mean, I have always been, you know, I personally have always been quite happy to be the dumbest person in the room. And that doesn't necessarily mean I'm not the smartest person in the room. It just means I'm willing, you know, I'm willing to say I don't know. I am willing to say I don't know, or asking the question that no one else wants to ask because everyone assumes that it's an obvious question. I think... Yeah, people get, I think if people are not confident in themselves, don't have, do not have the self-awareness to be able to look bad potentially or think, you know, because the likelihood is that they won't look bad, right? But even kind of do something that may end up with them looking bad, it leads to poor decisions. There are lots of decisions that get made because people didn't ask the stupid question or the seemingly stupid question or didn't admit to not knowing the truth of the answer. I mean, one of the things I always say, you know, as a CFO, we never talk in absolutes. We can only give you percentages, right? Like we can give you, you know, what is the likelihood of this happening? Well, I can tell you on this range of outcomes, this is probably the most likely, this is the least likely, but I can't tell you for sure what's going to happen because part of my role is predicting the future. Part of the VC's role is predicting the future, and you're predicting the future 10, 15 years out, right? Google, Facebook, et cetera, were not built in 3 years. They didn't become $1 trillion businesses in less than 2-3 decades, right? So at the end of the day, it's a long, long game. You don't get to those outcomes in the short term, which means you've got to poke and feel and understand like what is the direction and how do these things all gel together. Manish, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. Like again, I say this to every guest, and it is true. It feels like, you know, we could have recorded for, you know, plenty more time. Let's put it that way. For the meantime, though, for our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to find you?
Yeah, and it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for having me. You can find us. Our website is www.nava.vc, and you can find me on email at manish@nava.vc.
Amazing. Manish, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and have a great day ahead.
You as well. Thanks so much.